Welcome to Brain Body Movement, a series of talks based on a lecture series of the same title. The talks will be done in a more informal style, so you may wish to consult the printed texts, which are made available to you on my website, www.sam-gill.com. I hope you enjoy the talks. Thank you. Certainly one of the most fascinating developments in the brain sciences during the last quarter century has been the shift in understanding about brain plasticity. It is also notable that the emerging ideas on plasticity were anticipated by Freud and others more than a century ago. The traditional view, still widely held, is that the brain is highly plastic only during the first few years of human life. In these first years, the child is capable of uttering perfectly any phoneme, becoming fluent in any one or several languages, learning to read, to speak, to walk, to play piano, to perform complicated bodily and mental tasks. Yet, once this critical period passes, the brain becomes fixed and mental capacities are then set. During the rest of one's life, change certainly occurs through learning, yet the basic equipment and capabilities to learn are considered pretty much set. Thus, human development throughout the early critical years is understood as of a different order and type than change throughout the balance of life. At the end of the critical developmental period, where brains are plastic, the door is closed, the equipment and the tools are fixed, and from then on, one is rather stuck, for better or worse, with the mental equipment one has at that time. While the influence of genetics and environment, nature and nurture is hotly debated, most believe that environment plays a significant role in child development. Consequently, there is much attention given to what parents and schools may do, and most acknowledging that genetics also has a powerfully deterministic effect. Interestingly, my examination of the literature on youth brain development reflects a marked difference in tone and attitude between the critical period of child development and the post-critical period of child development. The literature on critical period child development has an urgent positivity about it. It hums with the concern that everything possible be done to support brain development during these critical years. The adult brain is being formed, so schools and parents are prodded and pushed into providing every opportunity and encouragement to these adult brains in the making, that they develop as fully as possible. Notably, the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind legislation is considered by many to be significant. A shift in attitude takes place as youth reach their teens. Suddenly, the lion's share of the literature addresses human development in terms of teens being seen as problems. There are endless articles and programs devoted to curtailing the brain damage effects of drugs, alcohol, television, risky behavior, careless sexual behavior, and so on. Surely it is not incidental that this shift from potentiality to problem, from positive to negative, correlates almost perfectly with the belief that brain development ceases at the end of the preteen critical developmental period. Recent scientific studies conducted in both clinic and laboratory have markedly shifted these beliefs about brain development, and though it remains controversial, the impact has yet to be widely felt in the general population. In her book, The Primal Teen, Barbara Strausch outlines the research findings of Jay Guide of the National Institute of Health. Guide's research findings, based on the studies of 150 living teen brains beginning in 1997, convinced him that teenage brains undergo periods when the cerebellum keeps getting bigger and better throughout the teen years. Teen brains experience periods of exuberance, followed by a rapid reduction to their final set adult brain level. Periods of exuberance likely continue into the early 20s. What this discovery means is not all that clear. Interestingly, Strausch, a mother of teens, finds it important as a way of understanding the erratic behavior of her teens. That is, it explains why there are problems. But it certainly raises the question, which seems to follow on the attitude about critical period brain and human development, of what environmental elements influence what happens to teen brains during these periods of exuberance and refinement. It is commonly held that some parts of the brain are more plastic, less genetically fixed during this period than others. The issue of what to do to assure full and healthy teen brain and human development seems to be only informally discussed. There are a few ideas here worth noting. There is a general pervasive attitude that is effectively expressed as use it or lose it. There is a general belief that since the teen brain is more malleable than formerly believed, the potential for damage from environmental causes, drugs, video games, and so forth is greater. But it isn't yet that clear what sorts of experiences teenagers might have that would be most beneficial to this seeming gift of extensions to the critical period. Guide simply says, if that teenage brain is still changing so much, we have to think about what kinds of experiences we want that growing brain to have. Chuck Nelson at the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota wrote, "The thing is, we know experience matters, but we just don't know what nature of experience matters, what's best for the brain." Curious to me, in light of my having for a long time studied the importance of play, Guide wrote, "What if we find out that in the end, what the brain wants is play? That's certainly possible. What if the brain grows best when it is allowed to play?" I'm not really sure what he means here by play. I'm thinking he has something like lacrosse in mind. It's provocative in any case. What is the significance of all this new information on brain plasticity to us as human beings and to us as students of religion and culture? Perhaps there is an analogy that may be of value drawn from our experience with computers. We are familiar with the difference between hardware, software, and application. In the realm of science fiction, we can imagine a merging and intelligent interaction of hardware and software, and the field of artificial intelligence is directed to progressively bridging the gap between them. Our science fiction and fantasy are built on the overlap of hardware and software. Certainly, the dancing, humorous, emotional wisdom of WALL-E is a recent and one of the most successful examples. We may think of the brain as the hardware we use to learn and drive our bodies, essential for us to live and interact with the world. Yet, we also acknowledge that not only is the brain physically growing and developing, but it is being trained and shaped. This second function is similar to the installation of more or less permanently resident software. We believe in the magic of the influence of the development of brain hardware and resident software during the critical period. But after that, we resolve ourselves to the fact that the brain is now hardwired with relatively fixed resident software and closed to physical extension. From this point forward, the brain works like our quotidian computer. Most intriguing to me is how this belief correlates with a wide range of attitudes and practices related to post-critical period human life. We accept without question, and therefore act decisively in accordance, that teen brains are hardwired, and thus anything having to do with teen brains is restricted to how to protect them against damage. Stroke victims are commonly relegated to the permanently disabled, because it is assumed that since a brain is not plastic, brain damage is permanent. Aging brains are considered to be like computer motherboards, certain to become outdated, increasingly slow, and progressively useless. Declining memory, forgetfulness, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, slowing, malfunction are expected of aging adults. It is remarkable to me how our understanding of the life history of brains corresponds with our understanding of the human life cycle. Perhaps it is actually the cause of a wide range of social practices that pervade our culture, from No Child Left Behind to the very idea of retirement and assisted living. The radical message that is presented to us by neuroplasty studies is that the critical period of early childhood is not completely closed at the end of the first critical period of development. There is abundant and increasing evidence that aspects of the malleability, adaptability, growth, change in brain's hardware and resident software can and does take place throughout the entire life cycle, where it has the potential to do so. Further, while it is not altogether clear specifically what environmental factors have the most impact, it seems clear that changes to semi-hardwired brain are interconnected with experience.